after World War II, they began to think of combat as also a production process. The officer corps were seen not as gladiator heroes who were leading men in combat, but as war managers. In turn, the enlisted men were no longer the citizens of a nation, but they were workers. Managers and workers worked on a production line to produce deaths, and the product then was enemy body counts. From an American perspective, if the only thing that counts in warfare is technology and economics, both in your economy and how you translate your economy into your military, then it was impossible for us to lose. And in fact, in some units, the informal rule was, if you don't meet your body count quota, then we're going to, you're not coming men off the field. There are stories of where people from different units had to fight over arms and legs to determine who was going to get the kill count for their unit. Search and destroy reached the point where many units burn down villages routinely, and then you go in a village and you burn it, and you see their bunkers there, because everyone in Vietnam had a bunker to hide in, and you hear a noise, and maybe you scream and try to get somebody out, but maybe you just throw the grenade in. Or people start to run away from you. And, well, if they run from you, they must be your enemy. And so you shoot them, and you say, well, running becomes a sign of an enemy. What's in practice is this Khmer group rule: if it's dead and it's Vietnamese, it's VC. Any Vietnamese we shoot, we're going to count.
We take a fresh new look at the Vietnam War from the highest levels of the generals and the planners to the perspective of the lowly enlisted man on the ground. You will never view the Vietnam War in the same way you did in the past. After spending this hour with us and the author of the new book, The Perfect War, tonight on Alternative Views. Sighting down the long barrel, I wait till front and rear sights form a perfect line on his body, and then slowly squeeze the trigger. The thought occurs that I have never hunted anything in my whole life except other men.
Vietnam, America's longest war, its most costly war, its first military defeat, and its most nightmarish national trauma. People are still asking, what went wrong? How and why did the U.S. get involved? Was Vietnam a tragic mistake, as liberals claimed? Did the U.S. lose because of self-imposed constraints, as conservatives claim? Could we have won the war if we just unleashed the military machine and bombed the North Vietnamese back to the Stone Age? What was the cost of Vietnam, the human cost, the political cost, the economic cost to both the United States and the Vietnamese? One person who has been researching these questions for over 10 years is William Gibson, who has just published a book, The Perfect War, Techno-War in Vietnam, with Atlantic Monthly Press. Bill is a graduate of the University of Texas, where he did his undergraduate work, and he got his PhD at Yale University and is now a professor of sociology at Southern Methodist University in Dallas. And we're very pleased to have you with us today on Alternative Views, Bill, to discuss your Vietnam book.
This is an incredible book, Bill. If you have read a lot about Vietnam, or if you have never read anything about Vietnam, this is the one you should read, because it shows the picture from the top, from the bottom, and it gives an explanation as to what really happened there and why things happen. Usually you come back with kind of an empty feeling of frustration or not really knowing, but you, after reading your book, you understand, which is incredible.
Oh, thank
thing.
You.
And you get the emotional feeling, the impact, as well as what was happening in the mines. And these incredible stories like how the North Vietnamese were able to bring down American jets just by lying on their back and firing 45s and rifles up into the sky. But I'm getting ahead of the story.
Yes, Bill, let's begin by talking about what, in your opinion, is distinctive about the Vietnam War. What brought about U.S. involvement in this ill-fated adventure?
The most distinctive feature of the Vietnam War is that it was the first war in modern times to be fought from a managerial business perspective. During World War II, U.S. industry made a massive contribution to the war effort, and American military men and political leaders fully appreciated that effort. During World War II, the military partially adopted a business model of organization for their supply operation. After World War II, they began to think of combat as also a production process. The officer corps were seen not as gladiator heroes who were leading men in combat, but as war managers. In turn, the enlisted men were no longer the citizens of a nation, but they were workers. Managers and workers worked on a production line to produce deaths, and the product then was enemy body counts. So just as American society's strength, supposedly, was high technology, capital-intensive business, so too would we fight wars as high technology, capital-intensive warfare, and we would literally drive the other side bankrupt. So it's this production model of war, or what I call techno-war, that distinguishes, at a primary structural level, Vietnam from other warfare.
So then in this way, we couldn't lose, because we were fighting a small, underdeveloped, untechnical third world country with peasants, basically.
Exactly. From an American perspective, if the only thing that counts in warfare is technology and economics, both in your economy and how you translate your economy into your military, then it was impossible for us to lose. It was theoretically impossible for an underdeveloped peasant economy to beat the United States. It just couldn't happen. Therefore, whenever we ran into a problem in 54 or 60 or 64, at every time the U.S. was defeated, we always thought that if we escalated to the next highest level, we would win. It's a closed system.
And Bill, why was Vietnam chosen as the site for the first techno war?
There's no historical reason for Vietnam. In other words, really, Vietnam as a country, as a people, as a culture, didn't really matter to the Americans. So there was nothing about the country per se to make us fight there. It was simply the time when this whole apparatus of warfare was developing, vis-a-vis the time when the situation in Vietnam was deteriorating from an American perspective. Techno war, or this production model of war, got its big push in the 50s. Because after World War II, when we had the hydrogen bomb or the atomic bomb, and then later the hydrogen bomb, and the Russians didn't, it seemed clear to us that our mastery of the world was just unsurpassed and we could not be challenged. But when the Russians had the bomb, we were in a situation of potentially mutual destruction, where they could destroy our industrial apparatus. Then this made the Americans feel impotent. And so the question came is, how can we develop a form of warfare to and exercise our power in the world without threatening nuclear war? And the idea developed by Dr. Henry Kissinger, who at the time was a professor at political science at Harvard, was what's called limited war. And the idea was, because our economy was so big and powerful, we could have guns and butter. Butter and TVs and popcorn and drive-ins for and hula hoops for the Americans at home. And limited war for an indefinite period of time in the third world. And because we were so much richer, we would just drive the other side bankrupt.
And it was a period where certain guerrilla movements, certain national liberation movements were emerging. We saw the Cuban Revolution in 1959, and there were Third World revolutionary movements throughout Latin America, Western Africa, South Asia.
The French and British empires were deteriorating worldwide. Certainly, right. And Vietnam's a classic case of that. Vietnam had been a French colony that went through a long process of revolt. So Vietnam was just simply, it was ready. We had our theory for limited war, and we had our apparatus in place at the time Vietnam was by the time the French had been thrown out.
Can you give us a brief history of Vietnam and their struggle, first against the Chinese and then the French, et cetera, leading up to American intervention?
Certainly. The word Vietnam originally, it means Southern Kingdom of the Viet, and it was a part of China that, well, didn't really break off. It's like Chinese immigrated there, and they formed a racially distinct group and tried to claim independence. Chinese emperors would invade Vietnam, hold the country for several hundred years. Vietnamese guerrilla fighters would throw the Chinese out. The Chinese would then invade and hold it for another 1,500 years. Then the Vietnamese would throw them out and hold on for 50 years. This struggle between Vietnam and China for Vietnamese independence went on for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Finally, by the time the Vietnamese had finally defeated China, they were in pride. They were weak, though. And but this is the time when the West was expanding, and France was looking for a way to get to China for the spice trade and so on, and they ended up taking Vietnam. So France took Vietnam as a colony in the 1890s. Vietnamese fought off and on against the French from the 1890s on up. Oh, they just kept on fighting. But then in World War II, the communists, especially headed by Ho Chi Minh and Vo Nguyen Giap and Lai Duc Tho, organized better. They fought against the Japanese, and then after declared their independence in 1945, and ironically, American intelligence operatives supported that effort extensively.
And Ho Chi Minh, as I understand it, looked at that time to the United States as a model to develop his country, not to the Soviet Union.
His position was that he had paid off whatever he felt he ideologically owed to the Soviet Union, and that he was a free agent, he was not getting any assistance, and that the America, with the Declaration of Independence and with its stated anti-imperialist policy, was a far better possible ally.
And it was a model of democracy for him, too, and at that time he was a nationalist and a Democrat to some extent.
Certainly a nationalist. How much a Democrat? I'm not. I wouldn't. He was pretty much.
He at least paid lip service to the democratic values and the anti-imperialist.
But certainly a nationalist.
Yeah. Well, then the Vietnamese defeated the French
in 1954 after 8 years of extensive warfare, extensive guerrilla warfare. And it's important for us to understand the war in Vietnam was one country. It had been tentatively divided into three administrative zones by the French, but warfare was going on all three. When the war ended in 1954, the country looked like a checkerboard. Some French in the north, some Vietnamese or Viet Minh in the north, some French cities held in the south, other areas held by the Vietnamese communists. North and South Vietnam didn't exist. It was only a checkerboard. But then, at the Geneva peace talks in 1954, there was a land swap. Vietnamese forces moved north, French consolidated their forces in the south. A line was drawn, a provisional administrative boundary, not a national boundary, not a political boundary, an administrative zone boundary. And the idea was the country would be divided for 2 years and there would be international elections in 1956. There were no such elections. The United States moved in. But what's important to understand, this idea of North Vietnam as a separate country that invaded South Vietnam is wrong. There was no North and South Vietnam as two separate countries. That was it was a checkerboard at the end of 1954 that got changed.
And what happened in the South to begin the resistance struggle?
In 1954, the Viet Cong in the South were told to put down their guns and that they were going to engage in political struggle for 2 years in preparation for the 1956 elections. That became extremely dangerous. Diem, the man the Americans put in power, immediately went after and hunted down most of the communists, leftists, Democrats, nationalists. In other words, Diem and his family ruled Vietnam pretty much as a dictatorship. And finally, by the late 50s, the local communist and guerrilla and socialist and democratic apparatus was taking casualties so badly that they had to renew the armed struggle to survive. And so simply then the southern cadres put pressure on the north, on the Communist Party, to like reopen the military front and have a joint political and military strategy as opposed to simply trying to wait for international intervention or by the United Nations or something. So that's the origin of resistance.
Now, what was the U.S. response to this then?
Well, the response was quite simple. This is when the Green Berets, who had originally been formed to parachute into Eastern Europe after to organize guerrilla movements in Eastern Europe, got reformulated as counterinsurgency experts, and they were sent to Vietnam by President Kennedy in 1960. There was also a massive increase in CIA operations. The whole idea of covert warfare, remember, and counterinsurgency warfare, remember, we had failed at the Bay of Pigs in 1961? And so the idea was that we must become experts at fighting these wars of national liberation, and that we must have new warrior technicians who could intervene in underdeveloped countries and fix things. And the Green Berets were one branch of fix-it men, CIA operatives were another, various logistics people, economists were others. We should remember, let's understand the class structure of Vietnam. It's a poor rural society. Most of the people are landless peasants or own very small plots of land. They're under subsistence agriculture, where a large part of their crop goes to the landlord. A small landowning class, most peasants are Buddhist with practiced elements of Confucianism as well. A small landowning class, many of them refugees from the north, many of them Catholic, controls the nation's wealth. So Diem and the government, Diem, uses then the army as a mechanism to collect rents. And during the first war against the French, the Viet Cong had redistributed the land to the peasantry. So when Diem came to power in 54 with the army and acted as agents of the landlord to collect years of back rent, essentially the internal class polarization increased one more time.
And drove people of the Viet Cong into revolutionary perspective.
Exactly.
And then Diem had to use more and more repression as a result of the dissatisfaction of the
And the repression in turn meant that in essence that the Viet Cong or communist forces felt like they had to resort to armed struggle again.
So this is why you made your statement in your book that Diem had an army but he was not a government.
That's right. No, there was no effective administration other than military administration. Diem eventually replaced all forms of village council, all forms of intermediary powers that had any linkage to below were destroyed. Instead, all loyalty was from the top down.
Yet the American escalation didn't really dramatically accelerate until after Diem's assassination. What brought about this dramatic acceleration and what you call techno-war to Vietnam?
When Diem was gone, all the other Vietnamese generals began a power struggle among themselves. Consequently, whatever government repressive apparatus Diem had collapsed. Desertions increased radically. Defections to Viet Cong units became stronger and stronger. By 64, American policymakers feared that there would be a provisional revolutionary government, an open provisional revolutionary government in much of the countryside, which we had lost. Remember, it's straight. U.S. forces lost, or the French lost in 45. We lost again in 54. We lost again in 63, 64. We escalate, the United States escalates in the face of defeat, not in the face of victory.
Right.
So massive defeat in 63 and 64 brought in then the need for U.S. ground troops and sustained bombing of the north in order to try to salvage the situation.
Why couldn't the U.S. accept a defeat in this small corner of the world?
The United States has been unwilling to deal with communism as a political, social, and economic movement. Instead, it gets seen that we as Americans are the natural beings of the world, and that capitalism is the natural economic order, and that our system is simply the essence of human goodness and the essence of nature. Therefore, something very, very different from us is not another society with whom one compares differences and makes treaties with and so on and so forth, but instead is an alien presence. If we're nature, they're anti-nature, or what I call the foreign other. During World War II, the Soviet Union did take over, right after World War II, did invade and take over Eastern Europe, the Red Army did, and you had to hold it as a buffer zone, and they did install puppet dictatorships there. This became the model for all American views of communist and socialist of any kind. Americans did not understand internal revolution. They did not understand the Chinese Revolution in the 40s, that there were like millions upon millions of poor peasants who wanted land to survive, and that Mao Zedong and the Communist Party offered them land and survival, whereas Chiang Kai-shek was a warlord who offered them nothing. So, unable to see internal struggles for socialism or communism, or unable to see even internal struggles for national independence against colonialism,
right,
the world gets divided into them and us.
Mm-hmm.
And we're the good guys and they're the bad guys. They are the foreign other. They're trying to move in. So all forms of communism movements get seen in that light. So in this sense, then, any particular movement in the world is not just a particular movement in a dirt-poor country. I mean, let's remember how dirt-poor Vietnam is then. And we had very little investment there. Instead, any movement is a sign of the global movement. A victory,
by the Soviet Union.
A few poor peasants win in Vietnam. That doesn't mean just that they have, that a little few more people have a few more rights. Instead, that means that the foreign other, the monolithic machine, has encroached one more step, and that with each other step, the rest of the world becomes in peril. This, of course, is the domino theory. So like a contagious disease, sort of, instead of like each country having its own history and its own culture and its own people. It's as if the world is an empty shell, like a chessboard, and it's either our side or their side, and once they get going, just somehow a mechanistic momentum will propel communism to victory. It's a very, I call it mechanistic anti-communism, because it's a mechanistic framework of the world, and the enemy is foreign other. They aren't really real enemy at all. It's an abstraction.
So isn't that also, aren't there two sides of this? The other side is the people, the big decision makers, the foreign policy establishment, as you term it, looking at the world on a more realistic basis. As General Maxwell Taylor said in his book, we have to keep an iron grip on the third world country because they're poor and they want riches, and the riches would have to come from us. So they look at any type of victory, such as in Vietnam, as providing an example to other third world countries that if they can do it and get away with it in Vietnam, they can get away with it in other countries.
So it's a universal sign. The victory in Vietnam is a universal sign of national liberation victory everywhere. A defeat in Vietnam means that all liberation movements will give up their struggles.
So, Bill, given the fact of this military-industrial complex in the United States that had built up a new military machine and model of warfare, given the mechanistic anti-communism that was motivating the foreign policy decisions of the U.S. foreign policy establishment, and given the collapse of the Diem South Vietnamese government in Vietnam, it was almost inevitable that U.S. involvement would intensify, that this war was not an accident, that this war was not just a policy mistake, but it was a consequence, basically, of U.S. foreign policy and U.S. industrial and military development since World War II, that this was the test case. This is where they had to test their war machine and stop communism.
I really want to stress together that I am, one of the principal arguments I'm trying to, like, critique in my book is this notion that we just made one mistake after another, that nobody was really responsible for anything, that things just sort of slipped up. You don't go to war that way. You go to war far, far in advance. In 64, when Johnson was making announcements about the Gulf of Tonkin and just sort of like how it was a surprise attack, which it wasn't, and in early 65, when they were making announcements to the American public that maybe we'd send a few thousand more troops to Vietnam, they fully expected to send 200,000 people by the end of 65, another 100,000 by 66, and another 100,000 by 67. It was, the estimates were already there that it'd be, it'd take a 500,000 men.
So they had planned,
it was, like, it was a planned
war.
Out war. It was a planned warfare, a planned escalation.
Well, let's talk about the war itself and see how this techno-war actually worked out itself in the ground and in the air. The use of helicopters, the helicopter war, and the search and destroy. Can you describe these and how they worked in the
Well, let me quote a very famous general, Julian Ewell. Generals write books. They're kind of like academicians. They need to, like, write to publish in order to get further promoted up the hierarchy. We normally don't believe that, but or think that way, but it's true.
And to justify their actions.
And just to justify their actions. All right, Ewell's book is called Sharpening the Combat Edge, The Use of Analysis to Reinforce Military Judgment. It's published by the Department of the Army. And in the first chapter, Ewell says that we could compare search and destroy operations in Vietnam to an assembly line.
Wow.
That it was literally a war factory, and that the objective was, like, unlike a World War II or World War I, where you have a continuous front going on thousands of miles, and you have major offensives and then a counteroffensive and then a lull. In Vietnam, it's a factory. You turn the factory on, you let it run full blast all the time. And that's the managerial problem. How do you just allocate your resources, given the fact that you've already decided to run at maximum capability?
To produce body counts.
To produce body counts. Search and destroy means that somewhere between several hundred and several thousand American soldiers are going to search a block of countryside for Viet Cong or North Vietnamese troops, and they're going to try to engage them in combat and, of course, and destroy whatever troops or whatever supplies they capture. In theory, it's strategic offensive, meaning it's a way to put the Viet Cong, make them weaker, to put them on the, to hunt them down. It's as if we're hunters and they're the prey. The objective is to kill the enemy so fast that we reach what's called the crossover point. This is General William Westmoreland's term. The crossover point means you're killing the enemy faster than they can replace their casualties. It's like you're going to drive the other side bankrupt. All right, so with all of our high technology, with our helicopters, our jet fighter bombers, our tanks, we'll just grind them up. Now, that's the theory. The practice of search and destroy often turned out very differently, in that part of simply of a factory means a set of routine operations. And these routines were quite visible to the Vietnamese. For example, we just didn't all of a sudden show up unannounced into an area and begin the search. Instead, you had to, like, reconnaissance planes had to go over it. Artillery guns had to shoot smoke rounds into the jungle, into the landing zone, so that all the other artillery guns could sight in, so they could, like, fire protective artillery strikes around the landing zone. If you're any kind of Viet Cong commander, if you see a smoke round coming up in the jungle, why, you know that the Americans are getting ready to launch a helicopter assault. There aren't that many clear areas in mountainous territory or in swamps or in jungle. You can tell where the landing zones are. So many times the Viet Cong commanders had a very substantial advance notice upon when the Americans were going to begin an operation. Consequently, they had the choice, do we run and hide or do we ambush? The Americans then land. The second or first wave takes the landing zone. The second and third waves bring in more artillery. If you're a Viet Cong commander, you get out your compass and your map. You draw a circle, a radius on the map, and that will tell you, because you know that American artillery, 105-millimeter howitzer, has a 10,000-meter radius. So you know that the Americans will not march further outside the range of their howitzers, so you can tell where the Americans are going to march. Do you run and hide, or do you fight? So the same kind of principle goes on. It's in essence, they knew where we were, but we did not know where they were.
And they had the initiative.
They then had the initiative.
It's their terrain.
It's their terrain. So in essence, even by the military's own statistics, roughly 3/4 of the battles in Vietnam were initiated by the Viet Cong and NVA, meaning they ambushed U.S. forces and could make a decision. Also, most battles ended when the Viet Cong and NVA wanted them ended. They could, like, initiate contact and break contact. And those are two crucial definitions of combat initiative.
And your other statistic, that only in 2% of the search and destroy missions did we actually make contact, original contact with the Vietnamese. So it was their choice the whole time. And as I understand, the soldiers themselves on the ground, they didn't like this because they were the ones who would have to take the casualties first to lure the Vietnamese into battle so that then the Americans would know where to send the planes and where to send the artillery.
You send out a patrol in order to get it ambushed, in order to mark a target with a smoke rocket from a helicopter, or so that then the jets can come in and napalm the area. In other words, you have to get ambushed before you can find the enemy.
You know, when I began my Vietnam research, I had a hint that I was going to find a very cavalier attitude towards whether or not Vietnamese lived or died. I was surprised to understand the command's attitude towards their own soldiers. But let's think about it. We're talking about a production model of war again, or techno-war.
These are the U.S. war managers.
These are the U.S. war managers. Okay. We have a draft. We can replace all the labor that we lose can be replaced. And indeed, it's like migrant labor force. We're almost sort of like, say, we had a farm when you bring them in for a year, you know, a year to
duty. They're mostly blacks and Chicanos anyway.
Not most, but a whole lot of them are. They're poor, working class whites. The idea was, so what if they walk into an ambush? We take some casualties that way, but then we'll call in our airstrikes and call in our artillery fire, and we'll use our technology then to get the body count. So, in essence, the ground troops were bait. They were being sent out on operations to be ambushed. And that's not a good way to survive in warfare.
Night movement. That was suicide. That was one of the worst patrols you could ever go out on. The purpose of it was for you to walk up on Charlie and for him to hit you, and then for our hardware to wipe them out. We were used as scapegoats to find out where they were. That was all we were. Bait. Hell, they couldn't find Charlie any other way. So they loved us to run into a whole bunch of them. That way they could plaster him and they'd have a big body count. Then the general gets another goddamn medal and a big promotion.
Let's also note again, the highest officer routinely on the ground during Vietnam was a captain. A captain was a company commander. A company had at most about 140 people in it. That would be at full strength. Most combat units never operate at full strength. Everyone above captain's level, a battalion commander is the man who commands four companies. All battalion level officers, brigades have several battalions, divisions have several regiments or brigades. All the rest of those choppers, all the rest of those commanders are in helicopters flying at minimum at 1,500 feet. Because 1,500 feet is the maximum range of a 50 caliber machine gun when used as an anti-aircraft weapon, which until the latter part of the war was the largest anti-aircraft weapon the Viet Cong had. So the managers were relatively safe in this process, whereas it's the workers who are suffering the occupational safety
hazards
on the ground.
Was it a success in terms of the numbers and the body counts? Did they actually, in their own inhuman logic, succeed, or were the costs greater than the benefits, even in terms of their own logic?
Several things happened. For one, all the American commanders and helicopters communicated in uncoded English to their subordinate officers and ground troops. The Viet Cong and NVA were able to buy American radios in the black market and capture others. They routinely listened in into all the orders. There are many stories of people of Viet Cong hearing American orders and then taking actions to circumvent them. So the sheer arrogance of, you know, we're in our helicopters, we have all this stuff, we don't have to pay attention to our enemy, that ended up costing American lives. Mm-hmm. So that part didn't work. Mm-hmm. It took within a year or so, by late 66 or so, the Viet Cong and NVA knew how long it was going to take an American airstrike to get there. Now, sometimes they can make a terrible miscalculation and get caught out in the open. But an astute enemy commander could make a reasonable judgment on how long he could stay in combat before he had to run like hell, because the F-4s or the Hueys or the gunships were coming to after him. So a lot of times ambushes would be quite brief and the enemy would break off contact.
Well, we've mentioned body count a couple of times. Let's get into that and the whole framework of corruption and lies and cover-ups that occurred in the U.S.
It's simple from what we've followed so far. If the success in war is purely an enemy body count, yes, because we're trying to drive the other side bankrupt, and let's presume that, oh, you and Doug are, I'm a general, and that, like, your lieutenants are captains, right? Maybe you're a captain, company commander somewhere. You're under pressure. I'm under pressure to produce a body count. And as a colonel, let's say I'm a colonel battalion commander, if I don't meet my quota, my career is over with. I'll be relieved of command. And if you're relieved of combat command, then your ticket up the hierarchy is gone. So I'm going to squeeze you. And in fact, in some units, the informal rule was, if you don't meet your body count quota, then we're going to, like, you're not coming men off the field. We'll just leave you. I'll bring you some more ammo, some more food, some more water, but don't expect, you've got to, like, produce the goods.
I knew if I came back without a body count or at least a prisoner, I'd get my ass chewed. So I kept the patrol out. Well, I talked to to many soldiers who were wounded, the ones I saw in Japan, and they told me that some units were given a quota for the week. And if they didn't get it, they were just sent right back out again.
All right, you're under pressure. You're under severe, severe pressure. So what do you do? Well, you can do several things. One, you can just invent a body count. You can just out of the thin air and just call up and have tell everyone in your unit, tell your entire class there at UT to fire off their M16 for about a minute, called a mad minute, and call up on the radio and report that you have a body count of 30 or a body count of 5 or something like that. Or say you get ambushed, Frank, and your whole company gets ambushed. And you call in an airstrike and you call in an artillery strike and there's an armored unit nearby and you actually have an engagement and you find some enemy bodies. Well, what are you going to do? Well, if you found 10 bodies and you've got 3 different units, artillery, air, and infantry involved, who's going to get the credit? What if you don't give credit to the artillery? What do you think might happen then? What if you say, you fired, but you missed? Does that sound like a wise policy to you?
The artillery commander isn't going to give you any support the
next time
around.
He might be kind of slow next time around. Or those F-4 pilots might have to have, they might get a little slow too. It's in your interest to reward everyone. And since everyone is under the same system, everyone needs body counts, why, sure. We give you 50 Air Force, we give you 50 gunships, we give you 50 artillery, and we on the ground, I've got 5 bodies and I've got 5 rifles. We'll count each rifle as if 5 persons killed, so that gives us 25. And while we were out stumbling around, we found 10 enemy grenades. Beg your pardon, 10 graves. We'll count them too.
And body parts.
Say we find an arm or a leg, and say, because sometimes, really, when the airstrikes did hit, you can't blow people to smithereens. Unlike the war movie, where everyone has a nice, discreet death, in a real war, it's quite gruesome. There are stories of where people from different units had to fight over arms and legs to determine who was going to get the kill count for their unit.
And, of course, it got even more pernicious because they would slaughter Vietnamese civilians and include them, I mean, children, women, old people, and include them as part of the body count as well.
Well, we should get clear on that. In some areas of the war where U.S. forces were fighting uniformed North Vietnamese troops, there weren't too many civilian casualties. But a whole lot of Vietnam battles occurred way inside the country where there were Viet Cong, and Viet Cong and the villagers were very much the same people.
Well, now on search and destroy missions, they told us to kill everything that moves. So we killed everybody. Well, I just happened to be standing alongside the officer when the radio man said, "Look, sir, we've got some children rounded up. What do you want us to do with them?" And the officer says, "God damn it, Marine, you know what to do with them. Kill the bastards. If you ain't got the goddamn balls to kill a Marine, I'll come down and kill the bastards myself." And the Marine said, "Yes, sir," and hung up the phone. And about 2 or 3 minutes later, I heard a lot of automatic fire and a lot of children screaming. I heard babies crying. I heard children screaming their lungs out.
Search and destroy reached the point where if any, say, you many units burn down villages routinely, and then you go in a village and you burn it, and you see their bunkers there, because everyone in Vietnam had a bunker to hide in, and you hear a noise, and maybe you scream and try to get somebody out, but maybe you just throw the grenade in. Or people start to run away from you. And, well, if they run from you, they must be your enemy. And so you shoot them, and you say, well, running becomes a sign of an enemy.
Well, we'd been out for about 3 hours, and really hadn't seen anything. It was too hot. But then I saw this figure in black pajamas running along a paddy dike about 300 meters ahead and to the left. And, "Oh, hey, I got one," I hollered. 10 o'clock, he's mine." Then I muttered the warning to halt, you know, regulations. "Dung Lai, Dung Lai." So I dropped to one knee, squeezed the trigger. Crack! The figure in black went flying like a piece of paper in a gust of wind. "Ho, got some," Morgan shouted. "Nice shot, baby, nice shot," said Newcomb. When it reached the body, I nudged the corpse face up with my boot. It was a woman, about 55 to 60. And Wally says, "Stupid gook, what'd she run for?" We were in a free fire zone. And we saw a woman and a child running across, and the captain says, "Well, there, they're running." Well, in the free fire zone, if they're running, they're wrong. They're the enemy. So we shot them. The whole squad opened up on them. The next morning we went out, and we could see the cap of a child that was bloodied, and you could see where the mother had dragged the child away.
Troops are under, they're afraid, they're trying to survive, they're in a desperate situation, they're under a high pressure to produce a body count. So yes, we got into sustained slaughter of Vietnamese villagers. You go through and you look at a man's hands, and if he's a true farmer, he has calluses, and if he's a guerrilla who's only a fake farmer, he doesn't. So you go and you look at the hands, and those, if he doesn't have enough calluses, then you haul him away and you send him to an interrogation center. Or you look at the ankles. If a man is a gorilla, he must be running out there in the jungle getting his ankles all scratched up, where if he's a farmer, he wouldn't have so many scratches. So people would go, American soldiers would go around and look at the ankles. Or if he's a gorilla, if you ask him, you're a farmer by day and a fighter by night, you must not be getting much sleep. So you've got to have circles under your eyes. So U.S. soldiers would go in and look into the eyes of the Vietnamese and try to decide how many bags they had. And then if you have too many bags, you get hauled off. It was not our country. It was not our culture. We did not speak the language. And by the American way of looking at war, language, culture, history, class structure, these matters didn't matter. What matters, we had the hardware and they didn't.
Well, as the pilot of a helicopter gunship, we had a rule about the use of evasive action. Anyone taking evasive action could be fired upon. They never explained why or even what it was. But anyway, there was one incident I recall where we flew over a large rice paddy, and there were some people down there working in the rice paddy, maybe a dozen or 15 individuals. And we passed over their heads. Well, they didn't take any action, but we could tell they were nervous. But they didn't try to hide or anything. So we hovered just a few feet off the ground among them with our two helicopters, and we turned on our police sirens, and boy, when they heard the police sirens, they started to disperse. And so we opened up on them, just shot them all down. Well, it was 6:30 in the evening, and still daylight, and they said there was some VC out there, and they called on us, so we fired out there and killed off seven of them. Well, the word comes back to us that we killed seven rice farmers carrying their hoes. They're trying to make it back to the village. You see, we'd set up this curfew, 6 p.m. to 6 a.m., and so it was up to them to be out of there by that time. But hell, they didn't carry any wristwatches. They didn't have any idea what time it was.
So, yes, people got hauled away for interrogation and never came back. Yes, many, many villages were burned to the ground and blown up. And yes, many, 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 many Vietnamese, men, women, children, chickens, water buffalo, pigs, piglets, often were killed. Oftentimes you went into a village, the stories are you shot everything.
And burned the crops.
And burned the crops.
And that was houses.
Hmm?
And their houses.
And their houses.
Boy, you know, if the people don't treat you right when you walk through that village, you can give them hell. Yeah, they give you that snotty look they can do. You know, they won't say nothing to you. And we expected them to run out and welcome us like at World War II type of stuff. You know, hey, yay, G.I., hey. Well, as soon as we step outside the village, the captain radios in, we're under heavy contact. Then right away, oh, those phantom jets start coming in and dropping them 500-pound bombs. The whole village is leveled. And we go on to the next village. And that is search and destroy.
All this was, I guess, part of what you call the Mayor Gook rule.
Yes, essentially, if it's dead and it's Vietnamese, it's VC. And what it is armies have documents called rules of engagements that are supposed to specify when you can open up fire and when you can't.
On civilians or
on whatever. Anyone.
Right.
But they weren't used much at all.
Mm.
Instead, other kind of rules happen. Like I said, if they run, they're an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Or if they have black pajamas, that was one rule. Some units thought that any Vietnamese wearing black garb was the enemy. Of course, all peasants that wore that as their national dress. So there are all kinds of these fake rules that supposedly distinguish friend from foe.
Mm-hmm.
But all these rules were wrong in that we just didn't know the culture. They were kind of like fabrications that Americans invented to try to make themselves feel legitimate about who got shot. And but ultimately, people saw through this and said, look, what's in practice is this is the Mere Gook rule. If it's dead and it's Vietnamese, it's VC. Any Vietnamese we shoot, we're going to count.
There's also the factor of racism, too. I wonder how much they would have done this if they'd been fighting Germans.
Oh, it's probably much less. Of course, it says gook, slope, slant, dink.
One definition of a dead Vietnamese was believers. If they'd been napalmed, they were called crispy critters. And a one-liner went, when we killed a pregnant woman, we counted as two VC, one soldier and one cadet. Now, what you do is you load all the friendly Vietnamese, onto ships and take them out to the South China Sea. And then you bomb the country flat. Then you sink the ships. I'd like to burn the whole country down and then start again with Americans. Bomb the schools and churches. Bomb the rice fields, too. Show the children in the courtyards just what napalm can do. Strafe the town and kill the people. Drop napalm in the square. Get out early every Sunday and catch them at their morning prayer. Throw candy to the Arvin. Gather them all around. Take your 20-millimeter cannon and mow the bastards down.
Yeah, and this also tapped a certain sadism, not only in soldiers in the field, but also intelligence people. There were people who would, you know, collect ears and fingers and even heads, and even intelligence people would admit that they really got off to beating up the people they were interrogating. You know, it gave them a nice buzz, a thrill to do it.
When you go through soldiers' novels and memoirs, many have made valiant efforts to try to talk about the perverse eroticism of warfare. You sadism, clearly a very strong sadist dimensions, a lot of rape in the field, as well as killing, or a lot of rapes followed by killings and mutilations.
Well, maybe four or five of us, we'd go into the village and take a girl and bring her out into the jungle. We'd tell her to lie on the ground and don't scream, otherwise we'd kill her immediately. And then, how many of her guys there were? Well, they did what they want to with her. If the guys were in a good mood, they let her go. They weren't, they'd kill her. Well, the girls were unconscious after they'd been repeatedly raped. And then after they got through raping them, three of the GIs took hand flares and they shoved them in the girls' vaginas. The girls were bleeding from their mouths and noses and faces and vaginas. Then the GIs lighted the exterior portion of the flares and they exploded inside the girls. Their stomachs just exploded. Well, one day I was driving back, driving on a back road, and a guy comes over to me and he says he needs some gasoline. Didn't say why. Well, I look over and I see this girl, and she's stripped and she's tied to two wooden stakes. I don't know what they'd done to her before I got there. Well, they poured gasoline all over the girl and they lighted it. They lit it, and then they just stood there and watched her burn up.
If you look at a body count system and you see if that's the only thing that counts, right? The body count. If that's what rewards and punishments are distributed by, if that's your ethic, and if your own command doesn't really care whether you survive, then clearly you're in a world where anything goes.
It becomes a brutalized
It becomes a war for survival or a war to hold on to your ethics. I think a good example of this, Oliver Stone's movie Platoon, which is currently in releasement, shows a U.S. military unit that's severely divided between one group who commits atrocities and others who thinks it's a horrible, horrible situation. And I think that's a good illustration of probably the kind of dynamics that occurred in many, many units. It isn't as if everyone is a killer or a sadist. It's as if you're in a structure where a significant component of your troops engage in such behavior, but not everyone.
So it seems that then, you know, we talk about atrocities and we talk about me lie. When you use that term atrocity,
it applies an exception to the rule. That's not a good way to look at it here.
But me lie and atrocities were just business as usual.
Yes. Me lie seems a little well organized, in particular well organized, but certainly May Lai wasn't the only village in Vietnam that was burned down and where everybody inside it was shot. That is not true at all.
In fact, Bill, it was precisely this inability on the ground war to distinguish between friend and foe, VC and peasant farmer, that led to the next dimension of techno war, the pacification programs. The fact that they weren't able to tell who the enemy was meant that they had to clear out the whole countryside.
Certainly. Simply, if you can't tell friend from foe, then you depopulate the countryside and move them into concentration camps and move them into urban slums. It's not easy to depopulate a countryside. There are several major techniques. One is defoliation. You simply destroy the food base of the country. And this is where Agent Orange comes in. Mm-hmm. Agent Orange and Agent Blue and Agent White were sprayed on millions of acres of cropland. Other millions of acres of forest were defoliated. So with the food base gone, people have to move. Secondly, certainly bombing attacks on villages, which were quite extensive, encourage people to move. And then third, actual search and destroy operations where villages some of which everyone is killed, others of which you simply surround the village, move everyone out, then burn up the village and move them, remove them, these three modes. Millions and millions of Vietnamese lost their homes and were sent to concentration camps into urban slums. And what's so interesting is the Americans saw this as progress. This was urbanization. Rural is bad, urban is good. So even though they have nothing, it was brought as seen as a sign of progress to bring Vietnamese in where you could show them TV and make them work in American bases and so on and so forth. It was seen as having a more sophisticated job than being a peasant farmer.
This is also part of that same syndrome of not seeing the enemy in the as a culture or as individuals or people, but seeing them just as mirror images of ourselves, like the bombing of North Vietnam was supposed to hurt them if they destroyed their capacity to have consumer goods.
Certainly, and so the same idea, you would think from the American perspective that no Vietnamese cared about their home, that they didn't care about their land and their dog and their ancestors' grave and their rice fields and their trees, that instead simply just to have this new good, have this quote consumer good or live in the urban area, that in itself was just an unmitigated good. You're right, people's lives were not important. The human dimension was completely lost. And instead, in Americans, then we can count how many TVs were imported this month, how many Hondas.
Yeah,
so the logic of techno-war was inapplicable to Vietnam in a way.
Certainly, that's exactly. It could, in many ways, it could create tremendous destruction, but it could not stop a very powerfully united people who were trying to change their lives.
In fact, this will be our topic for our next program. We're running out of time for today. And next week, we'll see the limitations of techno-war, of why it failed in Vietnam. We'll also discuss what's wrong with the liberal and conservative interpretations of Vietnam. We'll see what lessons we can draw from the Vietnam experience.
We also will talk about some other aspects of the Vietnam War, the Tet Offensive, for instance. That was a big turning point in the war, and a lot of revisionist historians, particularly conservatives, said that it was an American victory. Was it or was it not? We'll also talk about this fascinating phenomenon in which the American army pretty much refused to fight, or many elements in it did. As a matter of fact, they started attacking their own officers and senior enlisted people in this phenomenon known as fragging.
And we'll conclude with a discussion of some of the parallels to Central America, of some of the failures of U.S. policy in Central America and how they can be illuminated by the failures of the policy in Vietnam. So, Bill, thanks for coming tonight.
Thanks, Doug.
This was
an
interesting, informative discussion, and we'll look forward to next week.
I'll be there.
Thank you for watching Alternative Views. We'd like to thank our director, David Galasich, our audio person, Richard Jones, our three camera people, Kelly Sweeney, Judy Burton, and Brian Lynch, and of course, Austin Community Television, ACTV. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. If you have any comments, questions about Alternative Views, or suggestions, please write to us at this address,